Hello, this is Rob Pearman. I've asked Ian to allow me a few minutes before he begins this week's edition of The Talking Newspaper. And once again, he's standing in for Alex while our young producer tries to get his own back problems resolved. Well, thanks to Ian for his continuing dedication at a time when both he and his wife, Jilly, are themselves facing surgery to treat their own painful conditions. The reason I'm chatting with you today is, however, because I've even sadder news. Some listeners and members of the St. Albans Macular Group already know that last Saturday we lost our much-loved and greatly valued secretary, Sue Fennell. Sue's husband, Norman, has written for me a description of Sue so that I can share it with you, and I've added a few comments of my own. So this is for Susan Jane Fennell, MBE. Who was Sue? Wife of 52 years to Norman, beloved mother to Claire, Fiona and Simon, Nana to Ellie, Andrew, David, Emily and Charlotte. But to many, including at times the family, an enigma. She rarely talked about herself and gave little indication of how she was or what she was feeling. She nursed Norman through his back operation, but didn't let on until quite recently that she was also having back pain. Sue was always convinced she'd be a nurse. Having completed A-levels at St. Albans Grammar School, she moved on to Guy's Hospital to complete her nurse training. It was there she developed her enthusiasm for operating theatre nursing. Norman used to joke that she was not a proper nurse because her patients were always unconscious. Having completed a year as staff nurse, she returned to St. Albans and started work in theatres at St. Albans City Hospital. She quickly rose to sister level and continued nursing while having her family. She applied for and succeeded in being appointed theatre manager for Booper Hospital, Harpenden, a post which she held for 16 years. She then moved to Harlow as a general manager in the NHS with responsibility for theatres and A&E. This was followed by a similar post at West Hearts Hospital Group, and her final role before retirement was as manager for a private eye clinic in Finchley, mainly dealing with cataracts. Running alongside this professional career, Sue continued with her work for the British Red Cross. Sue and Norman met as teenagers in the St. Albans Red Cross cadet unit. And while still training for nursing in her case and teaching in his, they became cadet officers and ran the St. Albans unit until Claire, their first child, was born. Sue was asked to become Hertfordshire Branch Nursing Officer, with Norman as Branch Training Officer. They ran holidays for disabled children during the summer holidays and trained Red Cross members at weekends. During the first Gulf War, Sue was asked to assist the Army in setting up a 100-bed emergency hospital at Bassingbourne Barracks near Royston. With the assistance of a regimental sergeant major, the officers, they said, were pretty useless. Within 2 weeks they were ready, with the hospital to be staffed by volunteers from the Red Cross and St. John's Ambulance. Luckily, it never had a patient, but the Army had been expecting a 30% casualty rate at that time. It was mainly for this work that the Red Cross nominated Sue for a Queen's Award, and she was duly awarded her MBE. In her words, those letters stood for My Bloody Efforts. Having retired, she then used her knowledge of eye-related issues by joining the St. Albans Macular Group. Inevitably, she became chair of this group of around 50 members, organising weekly meetings for a chat following a talk from a speaker on various related and unrelated topics. As if this wasn't enough, she also became involved with the Talking Newspaper, becoming secretary and also one of the team leaders, copying the weekly memory sticks and posting them to the many listeners. Just to add a personal comment at this point, I first met Sue at the Macular Group when she invited me as a speaker to introduce the Talking Newspaper to her members. Her evident organisational skills and her clear knowledge of issues affecting those with visual impairment made her my target to join our team and fill a vacancy as secretary and trustee. Fortunately for us, she agreed, and for the past several years, she's been a key member of the committee and a good friend to all of us. She had special responsibility for managing events such as the AGM Tea Party and the Queen's Award presentation and party at St. Michael's Manor. She also took on the key role of visiting new listeners to introduce them to the boombox and to explain how we operate. Going back to Norma's comments, Sue's love for her family was undiminished, and apparently there's a sign over the kitchen door that says, "Open 24 hours, Nana's Kitchen, where memories are made and grandkids are spoiled." That sums up Sue, always ready to help anyone at any time with any problem.
Hello and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the Saturn edition for the week ending Saturday, 12th of June, 2021. My name is Ian, I normally edit and produce the primary programme, but today I'm standing in again for Alex, who is unwell. This edition of Saturn will again be distributed on USB sticks. Please remember to return them in the wallet provided when you have finished listening. Additionally, the programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online. If you are using a mobile device, it's available via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. You can also tune in to Local Life on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM on Sundays between 8 and 9am and between 6 and 7pm and on Wednesdays at 7pm. In this edition we will have, on the USB stick distribution only, the BBC In Touch podcast. We'll have the usual news roundup and the national radio listings read by John Cushing. I will also have two items from TNF Soundings, a biography of Impressionist painter Claude Monet, and a look at the characters in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. This week's music is Piano Swing Blues by Gothby. So here now is the news, read by Gilly, Kalpana, Peter, Alison, Claire, and Liz.
Hello, this is Peter. And my first article has the headline, "Permanent Pedestrianisation Favoured by Many Retailers Who Trade in George Street." The debate over permanent pedestrianisation in St Albans city centre continues to polarise businesses, with many retailers in George Street now speaking out in favour of the move. In contrast to their peers in and around High Street, where there is noted opposition to the pandemic-led road closures becoming permanent, a proportion of traders in George Street have apparently taken the opposite stance. Harways Authority, Harts County Council, is currently surveying residents on whether to permanently close George Street, Marketplace and High Street, usually one of the main thoroughfares through the city. The consultation period has been extended by HCC, so every household in the district will have an opportunity to give their views on the plans, which impact everyone who lives, works and shops or spends leisure time within the city. Many George Street traders have spoken out in favour of maintaining the closure, claiming it has increased footfall and reduced pollution, but has come at a cost of the disabled parking spaces and the promised cafe culture has yet to materialise. Dylan's owner, Sean Hughes, says, "We are pleased to see people able to browse shop windows on George Street without forcing people off the very narrow footpaths, and I hope that moving forward we can get a positive closure or park closure that works for businesses and residents alike. The reduction in pollution is significant, especially because we are on the hill and had big issue with brake dust and fumes from clutches. The road is so much safer without these vehicles using it, and I hope that it creates a more positive place for people who live around here, as well as visitors to the street." Sarah Gillow of Galio Jewelers said, "The street vibe is great. There is a vibrancy we haven't seen for years on the street, and we are excited to see the pedestrianisation become a permanent feature, with neat access and beautiful pavings at a later date. Who knows, this may even be the first step to establish a beautiful heritage medieval cathedral quarter in the not-too-distant future." Mike Nuttall from Must Wine said, "It's been a leap forward in creating a very different business vibe, but most importantly, the customers love it from far and wide." Annalisa Atelier from Ferrari Monte agrees. The street closure is great. People seem to enjoy walking around much more than before, and we can think of something that will encourage it even more. The only complaint I had is about the disability parking, and that can be maybe integrated at the top or bottom of the street. But there are still those people unsure about the scheme. County Council Vice Chairman Councillor Annie Brewster said, "I know the leader of the council shares my concern that all views throughout the entire district are sought on any positive permanent road closure. This is the only way to assess if such a major change is likely to be beneficial to the greater number of people. Environmental and financial implications need to be weighed up. Less traffic in the city centre is a nice to have, but if numerous other roads are snarled up with idling traffic, this brings little benefit or worse. Some businesses report benefits of a greater vibe and a desire to introduce outdoor dining, but there are others in Verulam Road and High Street are suffering badly with many customers turning their cars around or not even venturing into the city. I urge everyone to engage with the survey, dropping comments onto the relevant areas of the city centre map on the consultation website." Thomas James of LA James Antique Dealership said, "Maintaining this closure will result in our business having limited access, which when we are dealing with furniture is unacceptable. People are very keen to point out the usage of trolleys to move heavy pieces of furniture. We argue that rolling a heavy piece of furniture up or down the street is A, not safe, and B, damaging to expensive pieces when the weather is anything less than clement. We have multiple residents from all roads around the area commenting on their upset over the reduction in parking, disabled parking and increased heavy goods. The survey closes on Sunday, July the 11th. This article is accompanied by three images showing the quiet areas with places for potted plants on George Street and the High Street, which has been banned to vehicles and they're closed to traffic, and looking much quieter than they used to do when vehicles were up and down these streets.
Next, here's a letter from the Your Opinions page with the headline, "Shops Need Vibrant Town Centre." It's from Michael Weaver of Clarence Road in Harpenden, and he says, "The County Council is seeking views about High Street recovery as we emerge from the critical stages of the pandemic and the lockdown. Are we going to see those measures that were imposed for safety and social distancing reasons continue in some form in Harpenden, including part pedestrianising the lower High Street and the removal of parking places? Pedestrianising roads like the LHS is a goal in itself for some. Many understandably love the idea of ambling down a fully pedestrianised LHS. But if we realistically want to see a thoroughly vibrant and bustling town centre, the full implications of road closures must be taken into account. Our town needs a centre where shops can thrive in a thoroughly viable environment. A centre like that represents a buoyant hub for the whole community. So what do shops need? They need easy access for all residents and visitors to get to them. There is a danger that we are making life far too difficult for vast numbers of our residents. Surely we cannot ignore that a very large proportion of our population needs to use a car. Our centre is rather like a valley with many steep hills. I'm fully aware of the enthusiasm that many have for walking or cycling into town. But seriously, how can you expect an ever-growing, ageing population carrying their shopping back to Tufnell's Way or up Bloomfield Road on foot or by bike? Is there evidence that our town centre shops will lose out if we do not reverse the current restrictions? There is. A few years ago, that stretch, currently pedestrianised LHS, between Station Road and Vaughan Road, was effectively closed by small roadworks by HSBC. Shop sales fell between 25 and 30%. The County Council was, at the same time, proposing pedestrianising that stretch. Over 1,000 shoppers signed a petition opposing the proposal. Likewise, when St Peter's Street was closed because of roadworks, the average fall in shop turnover was again up to 30%. Through traffic had gone, and the parking places too. The connection was blatantly obvious. Retailers have had a tough enough time this last year without the thought that social distancing restrictions are going to go on forever. Could we end up with a dead high street if many shops are not able to survive? Is it worth the risk? As for those giant flower pots, planters, lining the road from Vaughan Road, what on earth is the purpose of keeping them? They take up the place of valuable parking places in a stretch where cars are still allowed to drive through. For goodness sake, let's see them removed. Incidentally, the survey refers to the road in question as Bowers Parade. It is actually the High Street, commonly known as the Lower High Street. Bowers Parade is only that stretch of road between Skies and Keats Charity Shop. One seriously has to ask the question, did the person who drafted the questionnaire really know everything about our town?
Hello, this is Claire reading today. My first article is about a new campaign for road safety improvements. The Hearts ad is backing a residents' campaign for vital safety improvements to a major route into the city after the latest in a long list of serious crashes resulted in the death of a motorist. A man in his 30s was killed on a 40 mph stretch of the St Albans Road on May 27th after a collision between a grey BMW 520D and a black Mercedes C180. It comes just weeks after another serious accident in which a vehicle travelling from Sandridge to St Albans left the road just before the Sandringham Crescent turning, ending up in a homeowner's garden. Resident Georgina Cooper has set up a campaign group to petition for safety improvements between the King William traffic lights and Sandridge Village. This was a tragedy for the family and loved ones of the victim of this crash, and our thoughts are with them. We hope that this will be a serious wake-up call to ensure better safety measures on this stretch of road so that our children and others can live in safety, she says. The campaign has three main demands: a 30 mph limit to replace the existing 40 mph one, traffic calming measures between the King William and Sandringham Crescent turning, and a safe Pelican crossing near the bus stop so residents can cross the road safely between Sandridge Gate Business Park and Chalkdale Fields. The road is used by many pupils walking to Wheatfields and Sandringham schools, as well as parents with young ones in buggies trying to access DJ's Jungle Soft Play Centre. Neighbour Rob Davey said, "In the last 4 months alone, there have been two serious accidents involving excessive speed and dangerous driving. In both accidents, the vehicles responsible were travelling so fast that they ended up upside down in residents' front gardens, damaging their houses and on top of grass verges and banks. This part of St Albans Road is now surely classed as residential, with many houses and flats, and I cannot understand why the local authorities have not looked at reducing the speed limit from 40 mph. From my own personal experience and observations, it is only a matter of time before the unthinkable happens and residents or pedestrians are killed by a vehicle. This road is not designed for the volume of traffic or the speed limits in place, and something needs to be done." James Carpenter, owner of Carpenter's Nursery, is also backing the campaign. He says, "I have mentioned to the local councillors who come into our business a few times about my concerns with speeding cars. As you will be aware, our business has been here for a long time and I have lived on the road for 40 years, so I'm very familiar with these issues. The speed limit was always 30 mph until about 10 to 15 years ago, when for some reason it was increased to 40 mph. There have been a few near misses and minor bumps outside our entrance caused by people driving too fast. I am concerned that something more serious will occur at some point. In my opinion, a roundabout should be installed at the bottom of Sandringham Crescent to slow the traffic down. I don't know what other suitable calming measures could be put in place on such a busy road. Speed bumps and chicane-type installations wouldn't be suitable, bearing in mind the volume of traffic that travels along it. I agree that some kind of proper crossing at the Chalkdale Fields cut-through would be a good idea, as it is quite dangerous to cross there on that bend." Hearts ad group editor Matt Adams added, "We are happy to be putting the weight of the paper behind this campaign. Something desperately needs to be done to tackle the safety issues on the St Albans Road before there is another serious accident or fatality. To get involved in the campaign, email coopercoms@icloud.com. And there are a few images with this article. One shows floral tributes left at the scene of a recent fatality on St Albans Road, and another shows lots of emergency service vehicles on the Sandringham Crescent turning.
My next story is entitled Perfect Storm of COVID and Brexit Leaves Hospitality Understaffed. St Albans pubs and restaurants are desperately trying to recruit workers as a series of factors combine to create an extreme shortage of staff in the industry. Post-lockdown wariness from potential workers, plus the effects of Brexit and lack of service staff and chefs from overseas, have contributed to a crisis in the UK, as the number of hospitality workers has drastically reduced. Now bookings are on the up again, pubs and restaurants are finding it hard to fill the gaps. It's been a real challenge, actually, said Nick Farr of Farr Brew, an award-winning independent brewery and pub group which has just announced that it will be adding a sixth pub, the Bull in Whitwell, to its portfolio, which includes the hugely popular Elephant and Castle in Amwell. Chefs are the main issue for us. The quality of our restaurants is hugely important. We're really focusing on excellent menus executed really well, particularly at places like the Elephant and Castle. But finding enough chefs of the right caliber is difficult, especially when you factor in the number of covers we have too. We were already very heavily booked up before the summer weather kicked in. Now we're phenomenally busy, with bookings going through the roof. But it's a lot of hard work to feed and serve all our customers across our pubs and restaurants, and we need great chefs, at least four at the moment, but the talent pool is depleted. The mix of COVID and Brexit has been devastating for the industry. A lot of the UK's chefs from overseas have left the country to go home, and then COVID has made it really hard, in a practical sense, for them to get back. And then Brexit has been the last straw, making it much less attractive to work in the UK. Andre Lussman of the Lussman's Group of four award-winning sustainable fish and grill restaurants in Hertfordshire agreed. Brexit and now COVID is making the job market very tough, with every corner of the industry reaching for more staff as we emerge after many months of hibernation, he said. A large proportion of the industry, since being furloughed, have moved into other fast-moving sectors where skills are portable, such as online retail and the meteoric rise of food to go, and of course warehouse logistics, and so we have lost good people. There simply are not enough staff to go around, said Sean Hughes of Dillon's and The Boot in St Albans and The Plough in Sleepside. We still have our core team, but The Plough has a large garden, so to maintain the level of service we need, we've been training up new staff, and we are lucky that our university team come back soon. But our biggest issue is finding additional chefs that are trained to the level we require. Sean warns that the Brexit / COVID impact will be a big headache for our industry for time to come. He is looking to attract young people into his training programme at Dillon's, front of house and back of house. So says he will be contacting schools, colleges and universities to offer new Dillon's apprenticeships, which won't just be available to college and university leavers, but also to people who want to be part of our industry and learn everything about how a restaurant and a pub works from the basics upwards. We are looking forward to launching that later this week. Mark Pears of restaurant group Tabour said they lost staff who left the UK to return to their home countries to be close to their families. Others left the industry altogether to take up jobs in care, warehousing or delivery in the hope that life would be easier in these industries. And with Brexit finally coming around with new restrictions on migration, it has created something of a perfect storm. Now with the Tabour, St Albans and Berkhamsted restaurants back open and busy, they are short of staff in every department. Such shortages have meant we have had to delay the reopening of our newly expanded Tahini restaurant, which will reopen as a larger format Tabua Harpenden with 50 covers. At least, once they have been able to put a kitchen and front of house team together, Mark says that he has posted a job application recently for a chef de partie and had no applications at all. Tabua has been so affected by this problem, it has changed the structure of its business by setting up a central point, Tabua HQ, to prep food for all the restaurants, allowing for more flexible working hours as well as other practical advantages. Samir Berry of Infuse, an Indian restaurant and takeaway in the city centre, lost some of his chefs to India, many of whom have found it difficult to come back. Others have started their own food businesses in lockdown or found work in other industries. He said it is hard to attract new applicants and says the priority has to be ensuring he retains his current team. We keep the current team motivated and happy and keep the wages going, even at the times of closure and difficulty. We genuinely care for our team members and feeling is mutual. Christo Tafali of Ye Olde Fighting Cocks said, "The irony is that we now need more staff than ever to open and keep customers safe because of COVID and all the rules surrounding that. This means that something that was always a challenge, finding enough good staff, is now nearly impossible due to the diminishing workforce, and also the margins have got slimmer and slimmer. We have a large garden to the back of the pub and extended outside seating to the front and side. This means a lot of table service, which clearly relies on people. It's a constant calculation on my part as to whether we have enough people to open and whether it's possible to make any sort of profit. It's not an ideal situation for the industry to face." Olga Sipkeneka of Pertuti Restaurant on Hollywell Hill believes workers in the industry are being put off by rumours of not being entitled to furlough should there be another lockdown. "We are definitely one of the businesses that is struggling," she said, "and that is the main reason, I hear. So instead, applicants offer availability for shifts here and there, which doesn't really work for us as an establishment. As a family-run restaurant, we offer a lot of perks, with generous staff food, a flexible rota, and always opportunity for progression for those who desire to pursue a career within hospitality. However, the perks don't seem to be enough to entice people back into hospitality." Olga also says, "Workers are still wary of the virus, and despite the easing of restrictions and the success of the vaccination programme, there is still a lot of uncertainty. We have people who are saying that once things are more stable with the virus, they will get in touch," she said. "But hospitality needs people now. As the public emerge blinking into the sunshine, they are keen to socialise once again, and bookings are soaring for pubs, restaurants and events." Matt Elvidge of Far Brew said, "There's a huge appetite from the public to get back into restaurants and pubs suddenly, but we rely on young people, and the industry itself has been through such a lot over the past year, and these people are bruised and battered, at a time where we need them to be jumping back into the industry and firing on all cylinders to cope with the renewed demand from the public. We have a growing group of pubs and restaurants, so we're always on the lookout for hard-working, positive people who want to be part of a successful, expanding business and learn all about the industry. If you're a good chef looking for work, knock on our door." Andre Lussman is still hopeful for the future of his industry. "Hospitality will once again pivot, as it has done so well over three lockdowns, and recalibrate its staff base, with better training and developing talent from within. A combination of opportunity, good pay, and ultimately being an active part of something great will lead us out of this present danger. Hospitality is one of the oldest industries in the land and will bounce back."
Sustainability Festival helps to raise awareness of climate crisis. The 2021 St Albans Sustainability Festival will have a lasting impact on the district organisers have claimed. The fortnight of 170 events, including food waste sessions with local chefs demonstrating recipes from the Love Your Leftovers cookbook a talk by Delicious and Real on eating parts others throw away and Hearts Waste Aware, explaining what happens to your food waste once the lorries remove it. Festival chair Jill Watson said, "Local people's events were incredibly successful in raising awareness to ensure that we all keep climate and environmental issues in mind and continue to take actions to reduce our carbon footprint, both individually and in local policy making going forward." Harpenden resident Nuri Wyeth, who attended the climate change talk given by Professor Kate Jeffries, said, "Her message really hit home. I knew a bit about the climate crisis, but her words gave me the push I needed to think about changes I could actually make to lower my own carbon footprint. I signed up to the St Albans Counters In campaign, and I've now changed my energy tariff to a green energy company. A talk on recycling also made me really understand that we have to cut packaging. I will be buying more fruit and veg from the markets now." Many outdoor activities offered socially distanced outdoor activities. The Ver Valley Society's walk showcased the annual spectacle of mayflies swarming above the River Ver. RSPB, St Albans Evening Walk, spotted a yellow hammer, red fox and a barn owl. Breeze Cycling for novices and Hart's Middlesex Butterfly Conservation Walk identified butterflies in the Hartwood Forest. Children enjoyed wildlife events. These included bug hunting with All Saints Church, pond dipping in the Hart's and Middlesex Wildlife Trust Garden in Verulam Park, and the Harpenden Scavenger Trail. Thousands of school pupils, woodcraft folk, scouting and girl guiding members organised activities including Crabtree Junior's nearly new clothes sale and rewilding at Beaumont School. Meanwhile, St Albans Quakers' bric-a-brac sale raised nearly £148 for a bee charity. Naomi Randalls from the group said, "Holding the event was very valuable for the members of our Quakers meeting, as many of them had not been back into the meeting house or spoken with others live since March 2020.
Hello, this is Alison. Giant Bath makes a splash in Call to Save Water. Those passing through St Albans recently may have been shocked to stumble across an enormous bathtub in the city centre. The tub, which stands at around 125 times the size of a bath you'd find at home and can hold 10,000 litres of water, took up residency in the heart of the city to highlight St Albans' water wasting habits. The show-stopping basin was commissioned by local water supplier Affinity Water as part of its SOS Save Our Streams campaign. The campaign brings the subject of water wastage to the people of St Albans, as figures show that residents are using 6% more water than the national average, even though 59% of those surveyed believe that they use less water than the national average. Affinity Water's team encourage visitors to the tub to reduce water wastage in their homes and gardens and join forces to protect the UK's chalk streams. Daisy Cooper MP paid a visit to the team to see the bath and find out more about the campaign. She said, "It's fantastic news that St Albans District residents are using 700,000 fewer litres of water a day since October's Save 10 a Day campaign. And I'm really pleased to see the rollout of Affinity Water's SOS Save Our Streams campaign, which will encourage people across many more counties to do their bit to stop water wastage too." With Sustainable St Albans Sustfest events happening this week, lots of St Albans residents will have the environment at the forefront of their minds. So it's a great time to remind people that if we all reduce water wastage, we can help save our precious chalk streams. Coined Britain's Great Barrier Reef, chalk streams, which boast clear water from underground springs, are more endangered than both the Bengal tiger and the black rhino. Now at risk due to unsustainably high demand for water, 71% of Affinity Water customers have stated that they are interested in reducing water use at home. The new SOS Save Our Streams campaign aims to support them with tailored water saving advice. Jane Bellard, SOS campaign project lead, said, Chalk streams like the River Ver are incredibly rare, one of only 200 in the world. We are asking residents in St Albans to save water equivalent to more than 100 of our giant bathtubs every day to help save our streams. This is around 19 litres per household, which can be shaved off really easily, simply by turning the tap off when the water is running but not being used. To help the people of St Albans to tackle their water wasting habits, Affinity Water have created saveourstreams.co.uk, which provides tailored advice to help people waste less water. Affinity Water launched a Save 10 a Day campaign across St Albans last year, which saw residents saving more than 700,000 litres of water a day. Building on this success, Affinity Water is calling on everyone to take action to save chalk streams from the brink by saving 21 million litres per day, less than 10 litres per person per day. This is the equivalent of 140 million cups of tea, 37 million pints of water, 262,500 baths of water, and 8.4 Olympic swimming pools. Jane added, Affinity Water is committed to ending unsustainable abstraction from local streams, but it must be a community effort. Saving water at home will not only help us do this, it will support our efforts towards a zero carbon future. Councillor Graham McAndrew, Chair of the Hertfordshire Climate Change and Sustainability Partnership, HCCSP, said, "We wholeheartedly encourage residents and businesses to support Affinity Water's campaign to save our streams. The two key priorities for HCCSP are addressing biodiversity and water sustainability, and the partnership is working across Hertfordshire on joint strategic action plans to tackle specific countrywide issues in these two areas. The demand for water is rising, but you can play a part in reducing the burden. We can all make a difference by using a little less water at home or at work. If you do, it'll add up, and we can all help protect our local environment in Hertfordshire."
My next article is about boundary changes. The existing Harpenden and Hitchin constituency could be swept away under proposed constituency changes, but the sitting MP isn't worried. The Boundary Commission for England today published its initial proposals for new boundaries, which include merging Harpenden with Berkhamsted and making Hitchin a standalone constituency with parts of Mid-Beds and North-East Beds. But MP Bim Afolami says it's a long way to go before anything is cast in stone. "It is an interesting proposal," he says, "but I would caution against getting too excited about the initial phase of the Boundary Commission work. There is a long and meticulous process which continues for the best part of 2 years, so a long way to go. I personally love my seat just the way it is, and I think the fabric of its community represents the very best of Hertfordshire. Unfortunately, though, I don't get to determine, approve, or vote on the final iteration of these proposals, and that's probably a good thing." Lib Dem rival Sam Collins, who stood against BIM at the last general election, is not happy about the proposals. He says, "I am of course not especially pleased with the idea of the Hitchin and Harpenden constituency being split up. The local election results show that the Conservatives are about to lose the constituency to the Lib Dems, so you could come to the conclusion that this is a bit of gerrymandering. However, you have to look at the wider issues. This is about representation. Just tweaking the number of voters a bit in each constituency is a bit like that band on the Titanic playing on as it sinks." Conservative Gagan Mahindra is the current South West Hertfordshire MP, whose constituency includes Berkhamsted. The 2020 review of parliamentary constituencies was formally launched in January this year to ensure the number of electors in each constituency is more equal. The Commission will present its final recommendations to Parliament by July 2023, but these initial proposals offer the first opportunity to see what the map of new constituencies might look like. Members of the public are encouraged to visit www.bcereviews.org.uk before the consultation closes on August the 2nd. And there is an image which shows the proposed new constituency for Harpenden and Berkhamsted.
Hello, this is Liz. 5K Running Initiative celebrates its first anniversary. As St Albans Running Initiative, launched in lockdown, which became an international success story, is celebrating its first anniversary. Fly 5K was set up to provide local runners aged 10 to 80 with the chance to take part in a 5K every Saturday morning, no matter where they were, as long as they adhered to social distancing rules. They would then share their results with hundreds of other people in a positive and supportive community focused around their Facebook group. In the year since the group was founded, in June 2020, they have had more than 11,000 5K times submitted, with a record attendance of 430 on one occasion. The group was founded by St Albans strider Graham Smith, after he struggled with keeping fit during the first lockdown. I wanted some way of getting back to fitness, as I'd started to get really quite out of shape and was missing running events and parkrun. So I decided I'd run the same route every Saturday and use that as a way of measuring my improvement. I thought, wouldn't it be great to have some friends do this too, wherever they wanted to run, so we could all effectively race together, even though we weren't together. The difference with normal events was that we were each running wherever we were, rather than all in one place, and then sharing online, with our times being pulled into a proper set of results and published on our website each week. It meant we could run with people we couldn't otherwise meet, and that even included friends and family hundreds or even thousands of miles away. Pretty much from the start, though, it was about much more than just the running. It gave a lot of people, myself included, something regular and fun to take part in, and some much-needed social interaction, both with people we knew and people we got to know through Fly 5K. We have shared lots of laughs. I think in the midst of a pandemic, it has provided something pretty special and continues to do so. The group has now expanded beyond the heartland of Hearts, Beds and Bucks, to elsewhere across the country, and even as far away as Australia, with more than 2,000 members on board. They include Emma Steptoe, a National Standard Masters athlete from Cornwall AC, and previous veteran female winner of the London Marathon. Very, very happy anniversary to Fly 5K and everyone who has been involved and made it so totally enjoyable to get up early every Saturday and be a part of something priceless. Runner Laura Lane said, "Fly really is something special. Possibly the best thing to come out of 2020. It gave us all structure, motivation, and a lot of fun when we all needed it the most." Phillida Jones revealed, "Fly 5K has become an unbreakable habit which has done me and many others a huge amount of good." Katie Bunting, another St Albans strider, said, "It's been great to see how everyone has done each Saturday. I love the support and enthusiasm for everyone's achievements. Fly 5K is such a positive Saturday morning event." Nick Jarvis said, "Fly 5K has really helped me through the depths of a hard winter and lockdown. It's made a big difference to me." St Albans AC coach and Fly 5K host Steve Burren added, "I'm one of seven Fly 5K ever-presents, having taken part every Saturday for the last 55 consecutive weeks. I've also done a different Fly 5K route for every Fly 5K so far. I've got so much out of doing it and being a part of this fabulous supportive community." Isabel Head, 9, who runs with her mum each week, has now taken part 31 times, with her best time 22 minutes and 53 seconds. "I love running, and I look forward to Fly 5K every week. It's fun, and I enjoy exploring new routes."
And now the list of deaths, as announced in this week's Hertfordshire Advertiser. Eric Stanchel Harbour. Josephine May Davis. Kathleen Ruth Spicer. Vito LaMonica, age 90. Marjorie Wilson. and William Albert Whitehead, age 93. Bill was an avid talking newspaper listener and will be sorely missed. Now, an item from the Talking Newspaper Federation archives, a biography of Impressionist painter Claude Monet.
TNF soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hi there, Tanya here with a biography on Claude Monet written by Sarah. Claude Monet is one of the most well-known of the Impressionist group of painters of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. As a group of artists, the Impressionists tried to represent the elusive quality of light on natural objects such as water and trees by using dabs or strokes of primary colour. At the time, this was a new and innovative style of painting and a great contrast to the period of realism that had preceded it. Whereas realism portrayed objects and people as they appeared in real life, Impressionists created elusive and sometimes blurry images. This led to suggestions that the artists may be short-sighted. However, it's true that Claude Monet did have problems with his eyesight later in life, first being diagnosed with cataracts in 1912. For a decade, he refused cataract surgery, being concerned that his colour vision would be affected. But over the years, he became increasingly frustrated and eventually agreed to surgery. By comparing some of Monet's paintings of the same scene, for example the Japanese bridge at Giverny, painted initially in 1899 and then again after he had developed cataracts, it's possible to appreciate the difficulties he encountered in clarity of perception, colour and detail, and the effect the progression of his visual impairment was having on his painting. Monet was born in 1840 in Paris, and his family later moved to Le Havre. His father was a wholesaler and chandler who hoped his son would join him in the business. His mother was a singer and a talented musician who died when Monet was 16. Monet was more interested in becoming an artist than working with his father. Whilst at Le Havre Secondary School for Arts, he began producing charcoal caricatures which he would sell in a local shop. The shopkeeper introduced him to the artist Eugène Budin, who began mentoring Monet and, in particular, teaching him how to paint en plein air, outdoors. Budin was one of the first landscape painters to paint outdoors rather than in a studio. This was a pivotal relationship, and it developed in Monet a love of the play of light on natural forms such as trees and water. Monet acknowledged the influence Budin had on him as an artist, saying, "If I have become a painter, it is entirely due to Eugène Budin. They were to remain good friends with mutual respect for each other's art." In 1861, Monet was drafted into the army and went to serve in North Africa, where he contracted typhoid. His aunt, with whom he lived following the death of his mother, managed to secure his return home after he became ill, but made it conditional on him studying art with Charles Clair. Glare was an artist and a teacher whose students included other Impressionists such as Renoir and Sisley. This was a very important part of Monet's painting career, as he met and studied with other artists who were to become part of the emerging Impressionist movement. He also met and had a relationship with Camille Doncieux, who was one of Glare's models. They had a son together in 1867 and married in 1870. Monet's family did not approve of this relationship, and his financial state was precarious as a little-known painter with the responsibility of providing for his young family. Although he was beginning to achieve recognition as an artist, the French art establishment was not enthusiastic about his style of painting, deriding it as having vulgar colours and appearing unfinished. This was a very difficult and personally challenging period for Monet, leading him to attempt suicide in 1868 by jumping into the River Seine. It was Doncieux who helped him to recover both physically and mentally, although he continued to suffer from depression during his life. Doncieux was the model in many of his paintings, including Camille on the Beach in Trouville, painted whilst on their honeymoon, and La Femme à la Robe Verte, which brought him recognition within the art world. In 1870, Monet and his family travelled to England to escape the Franco-Prussian War. Although they stayed for only a short time, Monet became interested in the work of contemporary English artists such as Constable and Turner. The following year, the family moved to the Netherlands and then returned to France in 1871. The Impressionists were seen as a radical movement, embracing a different approach to painting with less traditional themes and more reference to contemporary life. Their work was often rejected by the Salon de Paris, which was the official art exhibition of the Académie des Beaux-Arts. This led to them forming the anonymous Society of Painters, Sculptors and Engravers, and holding the first Impressionist exhibition in 1874. It's been suggested that it was Monet who first coined the phrase Impressionism with his painting at the exhibition called Impression Sunrise, Impression Sunrise. However, Monet continued to struggle to achieve success, sometimes selling his paintings for as little as 200 francs. He faced further challenges and sadness in his life when his wife died in 1879, shortly after the birth of their second son. She was aged only 32. Monet became depressed once again, but took refuge in painting with a renewed determination to be successful. Monet's personal life was complicated. He was friends with Ernest Ochède, a department store magnate and art collector who went bankrupt. After the bankruptcy, Ernest and his wife Alice lived with Monet and Camille, and Monet began a relationship with Alice. Following the deaths of Camille and Ernest, Monet and Alice married in 1892. Alice was said to be so jealous of Monet's first wife that she insisted he destroy all photos and letters of her. Only one photograph is thought to have survived. Monet and Alice moved to the house in Giverny, now a place of pilgrimage for his fans, which attracts 500,000 tourists a year. It was here that Monet was to paint his most famous paintings and where he was buried. In his mid-60s, whilst living at Giverny, Monet began to perceive colours as being less intense and vibrant, and he was diagnosed with nuclear cataracts in 1912, but he refused surgery. His paintings between 1918 and 1922 demonstrate the impact his eye condition had on his paintings. His work appeared to become increasingly abstract, using large brush strokes and primary yellow and red tones, but little blue. He complained that the reds had become muddy and dull and became unhappy with his painting, saying that his eyesight was making him see everything in a complete fog, and he destroyed many paintings. His friend Georges Clemenceau, the French Prime Minister, described this, saying, "Monet would attack his canvases when he was angry, and his anger was born of dissatisfaction with his work. Monet destroyed canvases in his quest for perfection." Monet sought advice from ophthalmologist Richard Liebreich, who was very interested in art and had written about the effect eye disease had on artists such as Turner. He advised cataract surgery, but Monet refused until he was 82, when he eventually agreed to surgery on both eyes. He had been diagnosed as blind the year before. It's suggested that following surgery there can be an increased perception of ultraviolet light, which is otherwise invisible, and this may have led to Monet's paintings looking quite different following the treatment. By 1925, Monet was satisfied with his work, saying that he was happily seeing everything again. He died the following year, 1926, at the age of 86.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Jilly. Nominate key workers for free tickets to Pub in the Park. Organisers of St Albans Pub in the Park are giving away free tickets to key workers as a thank you for their efforts during the COVID-19 pandemic. Pub in the Park with Tom Kerridge and friends returns to Verulamium Park from Friday, September the 10th to Sunday, September the 12th. The people behind the Food and Music Festival want to say thank you to key workers and will be serving up 1,000 complimentary tickets at each venue on the 2021 tour. Do you know a heroic key worker that deserves a special day out? PITP is allocating the majority of free tickets to the NHS trusts in each region the festival visits, but promoters have saved 100 pairs of tickets at each location for locals to nominate someone they'd like to treat. Earlier this year, Dr. Nick Sherwood, critical care consultant and emergency planning clinical lead for Sandwell and West Birmingham Hospitals NHS Trust, was looking for a way he could thank all of his hard-working staff for their incredible heroism over the last year. Inspired by Dr. Nick Sherwood, Tom Kerridge and the Pub in the Park team will be giving away a total of 8,000 tickets to local heroes across the summer in a campaign called 1,000 Thank Yous. Celebrity chef Tom Kerridge said, "Key workers have been the true superheroes of this pandemic, and we want to say thanks by offering 1,000 complimentary tickets per region we visit, so these superstars can let their hair down while enjoying some awesome music and lush grub." In each town and city on the tour, Pub in the Park will be reserving 200 tickets, 100 pairs, for personal nominations. Tickets will be allocated on a first-come, first-served basis, with nominations open from June the 1st. For Pub in the Park in St Albans, key workers will receive tickets to the session on Friday, September the 10th. The deadline for St Albans nominations is August the 1st. People can nominate a key worker at www.pubintheparkuk.com/a-1000-thank-yous.
My next article is all about how a heart-based charity has been honoured with the Queen's Award for Voluntary Service, with special recognition for their work during COVID-19. The award, the highest a voluntary group can receive in the UK, has been given to Small Acts of Kindness, a charity that aims to reduce the negative impact of loneliness and isolation on the physical and mental well-being of older people, particularly those who have to make the difficult choice between heating and eating every winter. The charity, which has 300 community volunteers, works with 90 organisations from the voluntary, corporate and statutory sectors to source and distribute practical gift bags and helpful information packs to elderly people throughout Hertfordshire. Since launching in 2015, it has helped more than 45,500 older people identified as being cold in their homes. Last year alone, the charity helped 3,000 elderly and vulnerable residents in St Albans. Chief Executive of Small Acts of Kindness, Lynn Misner, said, "We are absolutely thrilled and delighted that the hard work and dedication of our volunteers has been recognised with the highest award any charity can receive in the UK. Everything we do is led by our wonderful family of volunteers, and this award recognises their efforts above all." The Queen's Award for Voluntary Service aims to recognise outstanding work by volunteer groups to benefit their local communities. It was created in 2002 to celebrate the Queen's Golden Jubilee. Dame Judy Dench and Joanna Lumley, OBE, publicly backed the charity's campaign in 2018 and 2019 to appeal to people who receive the winter fuel payment and don't need it to donate it to Small Acts of Kindness so they can help thousands more elderly people in the county again this year. Dame Judy said, "It's so important to think of others who are less fortunate in our society, and this is a really simple way of making a real difference to people's lives." Joanna Lumley said that donating the allowance could actually save lives. "It is a little shocking that we have many older people who are actually having to choose between food and heating when there are thousands of people receiving this lump sum who don't need it and would much rather their payment benefited someone who is struggling to keep warm this winter." There's an image with this article that shows, I think, members of the charity holding the tote bags for Small Acts of Kindness.
The annual St Albans Folk Festival will be going ahead at its usual time at the end of June, with online events featuring nationally known performers and local musicians performing live in pubs, gardens and other venues. Award-winning songwriter, folk singer and multi-instrumentalist Lucy Farrell will be the main guest at the online festival concert on Saturday, June the 26th. Her last performance in St Albans was as a member of the Furrow Collective, which had just won the Best Band category at the BBC Folk Awards in 2018. Supporting Lucy will be a new vocal trio, Arbrevin, made up of New Roots 2020 finalists, Kathy Bennett and Callum McKellar, and another young singer, Katie Coop. The opening online concert on Friday, June the 25th, will feature local performers with a wider reputation. Hearts and Beds-based folk trio Said the Maiden have been sending waves through the folk scene since 2013. After making their tentative debut at Redbourne Folk Club, they have played all over the UK and Europe alongside some of the biggest names in folk. The group relaunched in 2019 with new member Minnie Birch, whose gentle, intricate guitar style, warm vocals and unique songwriting ability add new dimension to the group's sound. Hertfordshire-based folk musician and songstress Lizzie Hardingham is paving her way as a powerhouse performer with beautifully delivered songs that sing straight to the heart. Support will be provided by Kelvin Davis, a country blues and ragtime musician with a British folk vibe, seamlessly accompanied by Gary Jones on harmonica and by Berkshire-based folk harpist and singer Eleanor Dunstan. Dancing is usually a major feature of St Albans Folk Festival, but the pandemic has ruled out the traditional day of dance. There will, however, be an opportunity to join in dancing from home on Sunday, June the 27th at 5 p.m. at an online afternoon of Cayley-style dancing. The dances will be taught by Lisa Haywood, who is renowned for her enthusiastic and creative style, and accompanied by live music from duo Gifford Brooks. All the dances can be done on your own or with a partner. Plans for live music, mainly in pub gardens, are still being discussed with publicans, who in turn are waiting for government announcements about changes to coronavirus restrictions.
Hello, this is Kalpana Block, and my first article is titled Return to the Stage. Members of St Albans Musical Theatre Company are rehearsing for their much-anticipated return to live performance later this month. They will be presenting the aptly titled Return to the Stage at the Roman Theatre of Verulaneum on Monday, June the 28th and Tuesday, June the 29th at 8 p.m. on both nights. After months without appearing live on stage, St Albans Music Theatre Company return with a spectacular two-part showcase, bringing the best of Broadway and the West End to the Roman Theatre Open Air Festival. They will be performing a show-stopping medley of contemporary and classical musical theatre favourites across two evenings. Audiences can look forward to performances from some of Theatreland's best-loved shows, including Mamma Mia, Six Rent, West Side Story and Les Miserables. A St Albans Musical Theatre Company spokesperson said, "Rehearsals are going well. We are having to adapt to the current guidance and rehearse in gardens and in small groups. But having had to cancel two shows and spend the last year providing entertainment online, we are thrilled to be getting back to performing live." As theatre and live performance make a comeback, these special shows will pay homage to St Albans Music Theatre Company's rich 70-year history, with an ensemble of musical numbers lifted from their back catalogue of sell-out shows. Producer Elsie Betts said, "Return to the stage is that adrenaline-fueling call to stage that performers up and down the country have been waiting to hear since theatres went dark a year ago. We at St Albans Musical Theatre Company are delighted to bring back live theatre across audiences with two evenings which promise to deliver the mesmerising, much-missed magic of musical theatre in the glorious surroundings of Verulam Park. The return to the stage shows will take place across two consecutive nights, featuring two alternating casts of local musical theatre talent, an especially tailored programme of performances on each evening. Musical theatre fans can also enjoy performances of You Can't Stop the Beat on Tuesday, June the 29th at 1 p.m. and 5 p.m. You Can't Stop the Beat invites audiences to sing and dance along as St Albans' talented ensemble perform a medley of family favourites. If you'd like more details and if you'd like to book some tickets, visit online at maltingstheatre.co.uk.
Love, Loss and Anguish on stage at Abbey Theatre in Skylight. A fierce pas de deux of love, loss and anguish that will leave you breathless, is the quote. This is how Variety reviewed the 2015 Broadway production of David Hare's heart-piercing play Skylight, coming to the Abbey Theatre later this month. A year after his wife dies, Tom Sargent visits Kyra Hollis, his erstwhile lover, in her northwest London flat. Tom is charismatic, businessman, a successful entrepreneur. She is a teacher who, working with children at the bottom of the social ladder, has dedicated her life to the service of others. As they fall into the battle of opposing politics, they must navigate their mutual desire. You can't help thinking that on some profound level, these two were made to be together. But can the gulf between them be bridged, or is the gap too great? Director Terry Prince said, "This is really a play about relationships, a wonderful mixture of the personal and the political. It appeals to the heart and to the head. We see both points of view, and any political statements have to be grown organically from the interactions between the characters. Hare balances the two divergent views of society represented by Kyra and Tom. They express these not as mouthpieces of a particular political point of view, but as two people committed to life choices which are very different. Set in 1995, but actually looking back at Thatcher's Britain of the 1980s, it is even more pertinent in society based on inequality, the society we inhabit today. The successful West End revival in 2014 with Bill Nighy and Carey Mulligan proved the play remains as relevant, as impactful as it was at its premiere. This is one of the great intimate plays of passion, ideas and complex love. Delicate, hilarious and thought-provoking. The Company of Ten presents Skylight on the Abbey Theatre main stage from Tuesday, June the 22nd to Saturday, June the 26th at 8 p.m. All performances are being live streamed for those that want to watch at home rather than in the auditorium. To book tickets, go to www.abbeytheatre.org.uk or call the box office on 01727 857 861.
Ask for Clive charity launches National Pride Initiative. A St Albans-based charity combating discrimination in the LGBTQ plus community and encouraging venues to become safer and more inclusive spaces has launched its first ever nationwide Pub Pride event. The Ask for Clive charity is encouraging venues across the country to host Pride events on Friday, 23rd of July. Pub Pride is a nationwide campaign that gives local landlords total freedom to set the scale and content of the night. Pub owners and managers are looking to take part in Pub Pride and are asked to buy a kit for the event. The first kit includes rainbow flags and bunting, along with promotional assets. The second kit will include, in addition to the first, six Pub Pride 2021 t-shirts for the staff to wear. All profits made from these kits will be split between Ask for Clive and the venue's local UK Pride organisation. Co-founder of Ask for Clive, Danny Clare, said, "We are proud to be uniting in the UK's LGBTQ plus community on one big night in July. We have already seen an overwhelming response from venues across the country, reaching out to learn more about the night. It is shaping up to be a national event reaching pubs in all corners of the UK. We cannot wait to paint the country with a rainbow and to show the world that the UK is one of the most inclusively diverse and accepting countries. It has been a horrific year, and we want to give the community one night to celebrate who they are, what they stand for, and to reunite. The night will play an important role, especially for those who have come out during the pandemic and have not been able to experience the love and support within their local LGBTQ plus community due to the restrictions." Owners of Dylan's and The Plough, Sean Hughes, said, "As a pub owner, Pub Pride offers my businesses a huge opportunity to showcase the inclusivity of our venues. Pub Pride will bring local businesses and communities together in a celebration of love and acceptance across the UK. And this will be led by local pubs, bars and restaurants." For more details, go to pubpride.com.
Now the radio listings read by John Cushing.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, June 12th. The afternoon play on Radio 4 at 3 o'clock is Castle of the Hawk, a four-part historical drama by Mike Walker, telling the story of the Habsburg dynasty. In part one, Hawk Rising, a stranger arrives at Duke Randolph's castle and is drawn into the Duke's plans to gain power. 4 p.m., Radio 4 Extra, you can hear a dramatisation, also by Mike Walker, of Len Deighton's classic 1962 Cold War thriller, The Ypres File. A nameless intelligence agent is ensnared in a sinister plot to brainwash scientists, with Ian Hart, James Lawrenson, Jonathan Coy and Fenella Woodcher. Opera on 3 at 6:30 is a performance of Mozart's final opera, La Clemenza di Tito, in a new production by Richard Jones, recorded last month at the Royal Opera House in London, the company's first production since the relaxation of lockdown. Egeris Monvidas stars as the Roman Emperor, with Nicole Chevalier as the Machiavellian Vitellia. And in Archive on 4 at 8 on Radio 4, Stuart Lee, unreliable narrator, explores why humans are drawn to the distortions of narrative art. Can fiction tell greater truths than the bare facts? Sunday, June 13th, Desert Island Discs at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma selects 8 favourite recordings and talks to Lauren Laverne about his life and career. Paul Weller, live at the Barbican, 7 p.m, Radio 2, will be a must for fans of one of pop and rock's undisputed grandees. He performs songs from throughout his career and is joined by guests Boy George, Celeste and James Morrison in a concert recorded on May 21st. Drama on 3 at 7:30 is Inheritors, the radio premiere of Susan Glasspool's 1921 play exploring nationalism, the erosion of fundamental American rights and freedom of speech. Madeline, grandchild of a pioneering American family, faces a moral dilemma when 2 fellow students are arrested at a college protest against British colonial rule in India. And at 7:45 on Radio 4, Damien Lynch reads The Chronicles of Bourke Street, a series of 4 short stories by Ingrid Pessoa, following the lives and loves of the unusual residents of an everyday street in Port of Spain, Trinidad. In today's tale, Boy Boy's story, a young man whose mother has died is convinced he's being haunted by a strange spirit. Onto the programmes now that are broadcast at the same time each day, Monday to Friday. Same radio station, same time, every day, Monday to Friday. Book of the Week, 9:45, Radio 4. The Devil You Know. Leading forensic psychiatrist Dr. Gwen Adshead reads from a book co-written with Eileen Horns about some of the patients she's met during her 30 years working in secure hospitals and prisons. In the first episode, Tony, she comes face to face with the first time with a serial killer. Composer of the Week at 12 noon on Radio 3 features Pauline Vardo and her Circle, 1821 to 1910. Donald MacLeod explores different facets of the extraordinary life of the French singer, pianist, composer and influential society figure. He begins with her early training as member of the Garcia clan, a family of singers originally from Spain. Just after midday on Radio 4, every day, Monday to Friday, all this week, Priya Kalidis's continues reading The Startup Wife by Tamina Anam. At 1:45 on Radio 4 is the popular 10-part series A History of the World in 100 Objects. Part 1, Maya Relief of Royal Bloodletting. Neil McGregor explores power and intrigues in the world's royal courts, circa AD 800. Lastly, The Essay, My Deaf World at 10:45 on Radio 3. This week's series explores what it's like to be deaf in 20th century Britain. Flying the flag, Abigail Gorman, who struggled to embrace her own deafness, now affirms her newfound belief that deafness is a cultural identity. On to the rest of the week, Monday, June 14th, 2 p.m, Radio 4. The afternoon play is Making Peace. In Tessa Gibbs' drama, set in the Northwest Highlands, 3 women learn about inheritance, loss, and the importance of making peace with the past. A new series of the comedy panel, I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, begins at 6:30 on Radio 4, hosted by Jack D. Regulars Tony Hawks and Marcus Brigstock. They're joined this week by Vicky Pepperdine and Henning Venn. Radio 4 at 8, Return to the Homeless Hotel. A year after rough sleepers were given emergency accommodation during the first lockdown, reporter Simon Maybin looks into whether the operation has had a lasting impact. And at 11 on Radio 4, again, It's Funny, It's True. In this two-part programme, Julia Sutherland explores how comedy can say the unsayable. Here she meets Janie Godley and Heather Ross, who share their deeply personal stories and challenging experiences on stage. Tuesday, June 15th, Vintage Comedy on Radio 4 Extra with The Goon Show. This episode from 1958 can be heard at 8 a.m. for those early risers, 12 noon and 7 p.m. 11 a.m. on Radio 4, The Blind Astronomer tells the story of Puerto Rican scientist Vonda Diaz Merced, who's turning data from space into audio, making the universe accessible to people like herself with visual disabilities. Truly the sonification of space. On Radio 3 at 1, over the next 3 days, you can hear highlights from the Song Prize concerts in the 2021 BBC Cardiff Singer of the World competition, which takes place this week at the Royal Welsh College of Speech and Drama in Cardiff. The Song Prize final will be Thursday, June 17th at 7:30. Back to Radio 4, though, on Tuesday, June 15th. At 2:15, the afternoon drama is Baselines, Mark Lawson's play exploring the challenges of the changing gender identity landscape for sports governing bodies. And in touch, as always, news and information for people who are blind or partially sighted. 8:40 p.m, Radio 4. Wednesday, June 16th, this week in Forethought at 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4, Ollie Mann presents The Meaning of Statues. Dr. Jack Buella says statues and memorials matter because they show whom a society values. He's working to erect more to people of colour, including a new statue to honour black nurses and midwives. Also on Radio 4, the afternoon play at 2:15 is Return of the Citadel, the drama based on the novel by A.J. Cronin about medical life before the establishment of the NHS, set in a doctor's surgery in the Welsh Valleys. It's 1930 and Doctors Denny and Manson both deal with unexpected events. The next episode is also the next day at 2:15 on Thursday. Unite is a new 5-part comedy series beginning on Radio 4 after the news at 6. Tony, a working class left-wing South Londoner, falls in love and moves with the Imogen, an upper-middle class property developer. Their respective millennial sons, Ashley, a disenfranchised Croydon rude boy, and Gideon, Eton and Oxbridge educated, are forced to behave like the brothers neither of them ever wanted. Starring Mark Steele and Claire Skinner. And at 9 p.m. on Radio 2, The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe features a special playlist of bee and garden related music as part of Radio 2's recently launched Big Bee Challenge, with classics from Johnny Flynn, Richard Thompson, Bill Fay, Maggie Holland, and Nancy Kerr. Thursday, June 17th, Blue, Pain and Pleasure at 11:30 on Radio 4 is a celebration of Joni Mitchell's album Blue, marking the 50th anniversary of its release. Blue has garnered high praise because of the raw emotion at its heart, with Mitchell pouring everything she had into writing and recording it. Contributors include Emily Sandé, Beth Orton, Ellie Goulding, Greta Sacchi, Seal and Elvis Costello. A new 11-part series of Open Country begins at 3 on Radio 4 with Dawn of the Sea Lock. Wildlife cameraman John Aitchison enjoys a journey at dawn by kayak across a sea lock in western Scotland in search of early signs of spring. He encounters seals and otters, listens to curlew and skylarks, and catches sight of a white-fronted geese, who will soon leave and head to Greenland. 3 p.m, Radio 4 Extra, Jim Broadbent stars in Abdication, The King's Matter, Christopher Lee's dramatisation of the story of Edward VII's abdication. First broadcast in 2016. Part 2, same time, Radio 4 Extra, 3 o'clock on Friday. And back on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, Sarah Kendall, Talking Story, is a 3-part series in which Sarah Kendall talks to different storytellers about what story means to them and how they develop their own style of storytelling in their respective mediums. She begins with stand-up and actor-turned-screenwriter and director Chris Addison. Lastly, we come to Friday, June 18th, and at 9:30 a.m. or 4:30 p.m. in the afternoon on Radio 4 Extra, What About to the Manor Born? the 1997 radio version of Peter Spence's TV sitcom, with Penelope Keith reprising her role as Audrey Forbes Hamilton, obliged to relinquish her country pile to a nouveau riche supermarket boss. It's in 10 parts, with Angela Thorne, Keith Barron, and others. The afternoon concert at 2 on Radio 3 is a live concert by the BBC Philharmonic, which includes the UK premiere of a piece by Dutch composer Theo Verbey, plus further recent recordings by the orchestra of works by Copland, Janáček, Tchaikovsky, Hindemith, and Sibelius. The Classic FM concert with John Suchet at 8 features the Los Angeles Philharmonic, recorded live at the Walt Disney Concert Hall, with music by Mahler, Beethoven, and Mozart. Finally, at 8:30, on the BBC World Service, Crowd Science, Marnie Chesterton does her best to answer the question, how do you weigh the Earth? Using a 400-year-old equation and a set of bathroom scales, and with a little help from the moon.
Another item from TNF Soundings Now, an intriguing look into the origin of the characters in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm Nikki, and here's an article from The Times by Ben McIntyre called Alice's Mad Hatter Was More Than a Fantasy. Lewis Carroll denied that his characters were based on real people, but all Oxford recognised his eccentric shopkeeper. What does Alice in Wonderland mean? It is an odd question to ask of the world's most celebrated nonsense literature, but readers have been searching for sense in Lewis Carroll's fantasy ever since its publication in 1865. That hunt for meaning in Alice's Land will continue next month with an exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum, exploring the extraordinary cultural influence of the girl who fell down a rabbit hole into a strange subterranean world of anthropomorphic creatures and objects where flamingos are croquet mallets and babies turn into pigs. A place of wordplay and riddles whose strange and vivid characters have become embedded in the culture, from the beaming Cheshire Cat to the irritable White Rabbit. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and its sequel, Through the Looking Glass, have spawned adaptations for stage, screen, radio, art, ballet, fashion, theme parks, board games, and video games. The books have never been out of print. Alongside the artistic interpretation stands a vast literature, thousands of books and articles seeking to unlock the mystery of Alice and ground her world in solid meaning. Charles Dodgson, an Oxford mathematics scholar, went to great lengths to hide his identity behind the pen name Lewis Carroll. He never explained what his books were about and was deliberately literal in his own description of what he had written. The heroine spends an hour underground and meets various birds, beasts, etc. No fairies. Endowed with speech, he wrote in Punch, "Most mathematicians reveal their workings out. Lewis Carroll did not." Yet by creating a self-possessed heroine of resolute common sense, he instilled the central idea that there is a rational answer to his fantasy. Stuff and nonsense, declares Alice, a voice of reality in an unreal world. For some, the story is a symbolic parody of Victorian culture, or a satire on the limitations of power. Off with his head, cries the Queen. For others, it is a story about the nature of logic and the complexity of language, or an extended joke about mathematics. One theory holds that it is a drug allegory, a hallucinatory psychedelic trip taken 73 years before the invention of LSD, even though the only drug Dodgson is ever known to have taken was a dose of aconite and arsenic for a cold. Another sees Alice's sudden bodily expansions and contractions, the repeated references to food, eat me, drink me, and being eaten, as evidence of an eating disorder. Still others identify darker themes. Dodgson was undoubtedly fascinated by little girls, but whether that was erotic or merely adoring has never been proven. He was interested in telepathy and a member of the Society of Psychical Research, which investigated seances, hypnotism, spiritualism, and the paranormal. A relative of Alice Little, the model for Alice, founded the Golden Dawn, a magical society that attracted the interest of other authors, including Arthur Conan Doyle and Bram Stoker. Dodgson always maintained that the characters in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland were not modelled on real people, but that was clearly untrue. In addition to Alice herself, an entirely fascinating seven-year-old, as he remembered her, he based the character of the Dodo on himself, mocking the stutter that caused him to introduce himself as Dodo Dodgson. The duck refers to Canon Robinson Duckworth, who was present on the boating trip on the Isis on July 4, 1862, when Dodgson first told the story of Alice to the three little sisters. The most intriguing and controversial identification is that of the Mad Hatter. Marooned perpetually in a never-ending tea time with his top hat bearing the 10 shillings and 6 pence price tag. For decades, it was assumed that the Hatter was unhinged because many hatters were having inhaled the mercury widely used in Victorian millinery. Then, in 1931, the letters page of the Times hosted a detailed correspondence identifying the Mad Hatter as Theophilus Carter, an eccentric furniture dealer in Oxford High Street. All Oxford called him the Mad Hatter, wrote the Reverend W. Gordon Bailey. He would stand at the door of his furniture shop, always with a top hat at the back of his head, which, with a well-developed nose and a somewhat receding chin, made him an easy target for the caricaturist. Carter was quite mad. At the Great Exhibition of 1851, he is believed to have displayed a unique invention, an elaborate Wallace and Gromit-type alarm clock mechanism that tipped the sleeper out of bed in the morning and straight into a cold bath. Unsurprisingly, it never caught on. The key to the Alice puzzle lies in a remark Dodgson made to the dramatist Tom Taylor. The whole thing is a dream, but that I don't want revealed until the end. The story begins on a hot afternoon that makes Alice feel sleepy and stupid, and takes place in the space between sleeping and waking. Like all dreams, it is both real and surreal, entirely believed in the moment, but strange and illogical. At once vague and intense, events take place unchallenged by reality or rationality, yet they are trusted as in a dream. Alice is a daring girl, willing to try the cake, the mushroom, the bottle of liquid, demanding to be drunk, and unfazed by the oddness of her dreamland, as sleeping humans often are. At the end, Alice undermines the very fantasy itself. As if suddenly waking, you're nothing but a pack of cards. That is why Alice's Wonderland endures, a dream on which we impose our unconscious desires, fears, and imaginings, a story that grows, not more explicable with time, but curiouser and curiouser.
DNF Soundings.
Finally, an item I always use on the primary edition of the Talking Newspaper. Let's have a look at events and birth dates in the past that happened in this upcoming week. On the 13th of June in 1895, Émile Levasseur won the first automobile race in history. It was called the Paris-Bordeaux-Paris. It took 48 hours and 48 minutes and covered 1,178 kilometres. In 1944, on this date, German V-1 flying bombs, also known to the Allies as the Buzz Bomb, were used against Britain for the first time, and sadly, in Bethnal Green, London, 6 people were killed. On the 14th of June in 1822, British scientist Charles Babbage proposed something called a difference engine, a calculating device, and this was the forerunner of the modern computer. In 1940, Auschwitz concentration camp opened in Nazi-controlled Poland with Polish prisoners of war. Approximately 3 million people would die within its walls. On the 14th of June in 1982, the Falklands War ended as the Argentinian garrison in Port Stanley surrendered to the British troops. On the 15th of June in 1381, the peasants' revolt against a poll tax was dispersed at Smithfield after its leader Wat Tyler was killed. And in 1919, British aviators John Alcock and Arthur Witten Brown completed the first non-stop transatlantic flight. On the 15th of June in 1934, Hitler and Mussolini ended their first meeting in Venice, with each forming a low opinion of the other. On the 16th of June in 1487, Henry VII defeated pretender Lambert Simnel at Stoke Field in the final battle of the Wars of the Roses. In 1963, Soviet cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman in space aboard Vostok 6. And on the 16th of June in 2020, support from Manchester United player Marcus Rashford and others forced the UK government to make a U-turn on summer school meal vouchers. On the 17th of June in 1940, more than 3,000 died as RMS Lancastria was sunk by German bombers in Britain's worst maritime disaster. On that day in 1962, US Open Men's Golf was held at Oakmont Country Club in Pennsylvania, and Jack Nicklaus won his first major title by 3 strokes in an 18-hole playoff with Arnold Palmer. In 1972, on the 17th of June, burglars broke into the Democratic Party offices in Washington, D.C., sparking the so-called Watergate scandal. On the 18th of June in 1815, Wellington decisively defeated Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo, ending 25 years of war in Europe. In 1940, Winston Churchill's "This was their finest hour" speech, urging perseverance during the Battle of Britain, was delivered to the British House of Commons. In 2017, Pakistan defeated India to win cricket's Champions Trophy at the Oval in London by 180 runs. Fakhar Zaman scored 114. On the 19th of June in 1215, King John and his barons sealed the Magna Carta, a statement of English liberties, at Runnymede in Surrey. In 1829, Sir Robert Peel introduced the Metropolitan Police Act into Parliament to establish a unified police force in London. And finally, on the 19th of June in 1953, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were executed in New York for passing US atomic secrets to the Soviets. Now some well-known people whose birth dates fall this week. On the 13th of June, John Basil Rathbone was born. He was an English actor. He rose to prominence in the United Kingdom as a Shakespearean stage actor and went on to appear in more than 70 films, primarily costume dramas, swashbucklers, and occasionally horror films. His most famous role was that of Sherlock Holmes in 14 Hollywood films made between 1939 and 1946 and in a radio series. He received a Tony Award in 1948 as Best Actor in a Play. He was also nominated for 2 Academy Awards and was honoured with 3 stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. On the 14th of June, Boy George was born. Born George Allen O'Dowd, he's an English singer, songwriter, DJ and fashion designer. He's the lead singer of the pop band Culture Club. At the height of the band's fame during the 1980s, they recorded global hit songs such as Karma Chameleon, Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, and Time, Clock of the Heart. In 2015, Boy George received an Ivor Novello Award from the British Academy of Songwriters, Composers, and Authors for outstanding services to British music. On the 15th of June, Wilbert Vere Audrey OBE was born. He was an English Anglican cleric, railway enthusiast and children's author. Better known as the Reverend W. Audrey, he was the creator of Thomas the Tank Engine, the central figure in his railway series. On the 16th of June, John Enoch Powell was born. He was a British politician, classical scholar, author, linguist, soldier, philologist and poet. He served as a Conservative Member of Parliament from 1950 to 1974, then Ulster Unionist Party, 1974 to 1987, and was Minister of Health, 1960 to 1963. Powell attracted widespread attention following his 1968 address to the General Meeting of the West Midlands Area Conservative Political Centre, which became known as the Rivers of Blood speech. In 1936, on the 17th of June, Kenneth Charles Loach was born. His socially critical directing style and socialist ideals are evident in his film treatment of social issues such as poverty, Poor Cow in 1967, homelessness, Kathy Come Home 1966, and labour rights, Riff Raff 1991, and The Navigators 2001. Loach's film Kes, in 1969, was voted the seventh greatest British film of the 20th century in a poll by the British Film Institute. Loach has been a social campaigner for most of his career. In 1942, on the 18th of June, Sir James Paul McCartney was born. English singer, songwriter, musician, composer, and record and film producer, he gained worldwide fame as co-lead vocalist and bassist for a little band called The Beatles. His songwriting partnership with John Lennon remains the most successful in history. His honours include two inductions into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, as a member of The Beatles in 1988 and as a solo artist in 1999. 18 Grammy Awards, an appointment as a member of the Order of the British Empire in 1965, and a knighthood in 1997 for services to music. As of 2015, he is one of the wealthiest musicians in the world, with an estimated fortune of $730 million. And finally, on 1964, on the 19th of June, Alex Boris de Pfeffel Johnson was born. He is a British politician, writer, and former journalist who has served as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and leader of the Conservative Party since July 2019. He also served as Mayor of London from 2008 to 2016 and Foreign Secretary from 2016 to 2018. And that finishes up this edition of Saturn. My thanks to Gilly, Kalpana, Peter, Alison, Claire and Liz for reading the news, to Terry for providing the radio listings, and to John who read them. Thanks also to TNF Soundings, and Wendy, Hazel and John for the week in history and famous birthdays. Let me take this opportunity of wishing you a safe, de-restricted summer. Please remember to return your USB stick and wallet after use, and please stay well and safe. Goodbye.